You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to SpyCast. From the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, the museum brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence. Welcome to another edition of the Historian Roundtable. I am joined again by all of the former Spy Museum historians. Dr. Alexis Albion, our first historian, who was here in the very beginning and left the job to work with the 9/11 Commission and the World Bank. She is now back here again, working on the development of the new Spy Museum. Dr. Thomas Bogart, our second historian, who is now a historian at the Department of the Army. And finally, Dr. Mark Stout, my immediate predecessor, who is now heading up the Master's Program in Global Security Studies at Johns Hopkins University here in D.C., where he also heads the program that awards certificates in national security studies and intelligence. Today, we'll be answering questions from you, SpyCast listeners. These questions were sent in via Twitter and email, and there were so many great ones, but for the sake of time, I whittled them down to three. However, if you have a question you'd like answered on a later Historian Roundtable, you can email them to spycast@spymuseum.org or tweet them at us at @intlspycast. So let's jump right in with the first question, and it's one that we get all the time. What is your favorite and perhaps more obscure spy pop culture, and we're talking mainly movies and TV, that has a modicum of realism? And why do you think it's more realistic than the others? Who wants to start?
Well, I'll go first if you like. So I am an enormous fan of a television show that aired in Britain from 1978 to 1980. You can get it on DVD now. I'm not aware that you can stream it anywhere, called The Sandbaggers. Sandbaggers was broadcast on ITV. There were three seasons, about 20 episodes. And it was actually created by somebody who had some connection, apparently, with the intelligence world, a guy named Ian McIntosh. He'd been a Royal Navy officer. He'd apparently served in Intel, who mysteriously died in a plane crash off the coast of Alaska during the shooting of the third season. But it's about MI6, or the Secret Intelligence Service in Britain. And the lead character is a guy named Neil Burnside. He's the director of operations. And he's divorced. He doesn't drink. He lives a very Spartan life. And he's a former head of the special operations unit called the Sandbaggers. His sidekick is Sandbagger One, a guy named Willie Kane, played by Roy Laughton. He's a former paratrooper who hates guns. He's sort of an amiable guy who's Burnside's conscience. And then the other sort of key character is Sir Geoffrey Wellingham. He's the permanent undersecretary, so the senior civil servant in the Foreign Office, and also Burnside's former father-in-law. And they've got some degree of mutual affection, but they also try to manipulate each other, you know, seven ways from Sunday. And usually Wellingham wins because he's older and cagier. Wellingham, by the way, is played by a guy named Alan McNaughton, who had guest roles in The Saint and The Avengers back in the day. And what I like about this is that the show is about real-life ethical kinds of issues that you face in the intelligence business. Burnside is a manipulative guy. He's ethically challenged. He lies to his superiors. He manipulates his subordinates. Just to give one example, in one episode, Sandbagger 2, so one of his valuable special operators wants to get married and leave the service, but Burnside thinks this guy's a really, really good officer and it'll take at least 8 months to replace him, so he tries to bully the man's fiancée into breaking off the engagement, and when that doesn't work, he tries to make it look like she's sleeping with some male friend so that Sandbagger 2 will break off the engagement.
So it's Grey's Anatomy with intelligence.
There we go, yes.
Soap opera.
Burnside, the thing is, though, that Burnside isn't per se a villain. Like, he's doing all of this in the name of MI6. There are really only two things that matter in his life, is the service and beating the KGB, right? But it's probably the least romantic show in the history of spy television. There's no Bond gadgets that stretch the laws of physics. There's no sex. There's almost no drinking. There's no Bond girls. Somebody once described this show as men in cheap suits dying badly in Prague. But actually, you know, most of the action, and I use that term loosely, is indoors in, you know, drab 1970s era British government offices with, you know, the worst furniture you can imagine. And I think the first, a very short speech that Burnside gives at the end of the first episode really sums it up. Special operations doesn't mean going in with all guns blazing. It means special planning, special care, fully briefed agents in possession of all possible alternatives. If you want James Bond, go to your library. But if you want a successful operation, sit at your desk and think. And then think again. Our battles aren't fought at the end of a parachute. They're won and lost in drab, dreary corridors in Westminster. So Burnside's a monstrous monstrous monomaniac, but it's the show's about real stuff. You know, what should be the dividing line between foreign intel services and domestic ones? How much deference do you owe to a completely incompetent boss? What should a manager do when he's torn between loyalty to the service and loyalty to his subordinates? And sort of ultimately, at the end of the day, does the end justify the means? I think it's fabulous stuff.
So you're a former intelligence analyst, so I got to ask, in all seriousness, will anyone who's not you find this show interesting?
Yeah, I think they will, because ultimately it's about operations.
Okay,
right? It's not. In fact, that if I had one critique of the show, is that, you know, there's one sort of token analyst who's traipsed through for about 2 minutes of every fourth or fifth episode. It's really about operations. You know, what do you do when an operation goes wrong and threatens a diplomatic incident with the Soviet Union, and you never quite told the Foreign Office you were going to mount this operation to begin with, right? What do you do when you have somebody very senior in the British government whom you know is probably going to defect, and you've got a chance to kill him before he gets over to the Soviet bloc, right? What do you owe to an agent who's in trouble somewhere and probably going to die? Do you owe him an effort to rescue him, even though it's going to be very difficult? Should you lie to your boss if your boss is incompetent and is going to make the wrong decision? All these sorts of things.
Can I ask you one follow-up question? I'm not familiar with the Sandbaggers. It does sound very interesting. Now, this came out in the 60s, early 60s?
Late 70s.
Late 70s.
78 to 80.
Right, yeah, because so I was wondering, you know, of course, in the 50s and 60s, there wasn't all that information on the Secret Services, especially in Britain. Probably even less so there than here in the United States.
Oh, very much so.
So I'm just curious, what is it based on? Who wrote this? Were these people who worked in intelligence?
Yeah, so or
was it made up? But from what you tell me, it sounds like it actually does depict the reality to an extent of MI5 and MI6.
Yeah, I would put it in sort of the same relationship to reality that maybe the work of John le Carré has. So, you know, all of the office symbols, you know, and acronyms and whatnot may not be right, but the broad structure of what goes on and the feel of it and the challenges and the dilemmas and just the ethos and the atmosphere are about right. The writer was a guy named Ian McIntosh. He'd been in the Royal Navy, apparently done some work with Intel, but wasn't in MI6 himself. But we are left to infer, and I think it's pretty clear because he's clearly got a good understanding of the intelligence business, that he had worked with people in MI6 at various times.
So he wasn't in the center, but he was close enough to
understand. Yes, exactly. He was
okay.
Exactly.
Very interesting. Yeah, I can follow up on that. My taste is perhaps a little more conventional, which I hope is okay. But that does sound like a very interesting series, and you know, maybe perhaps be a little bit more for buffs. But regardless, I mean, I'm up for anything that tries to sort of delve into the reality of espionage. I generally like, just like Mark, movies and TV shows that are not necessarily written by practitioners, but that are well informed. And it could be someone who maybe hasn't served in intelligence, but just like the makers of the Sandbaggers, are close enough to understand and, of course, are good writers. There are some movies that I think do depict the reality of intelligence very closely. A classic, of course, is Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which was just remade. Again, it doesn't depict a real case, but I think it depicts the reality of this whole, the paranoia and the mole hunt in the 1960s and 1970s.
I mean, it's basically very Philby. Close. I mean, it's not...
Well, it's Philby. Yeah. I just happened to have read a book about Golitsyn and Ozenko, these Russian defectors that came to the United States in the 60s and 70s, and the CIA just couldn't make out were these people real or were they dangles. Right. Is the information that they gave us real, or is it just disinformation given to the United States? James Jesus Angleton, former counterintelligence chief of the CIA, essentially stumbled over this. He just couldn't separate reality and fiction anymore. And I think Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy depicts this reality very well. There's a movie that came out very recently, Argo, which Tony Mendez of the Spy Museum was very much involved in. It's based on his own story of how he got some people out of Iran after the Iranian hostage crisis. And it is a very realistic movie. It's a great story, and it tells you a lot about how the CIA operated at the time. And then there are some movies that are not necessarily spy movies or don't necessarily depict real cases, but they sort of tell you bigger truth. I mean, one of my all-time favorites is The Manchurian Candidate. The book, the first movie, and the second movie. It's very rare that
I didn't know
you
there
have
was
these
a second movie.
Yes, there was a remake with Denzel Washington.
And they all depict
some realities, not necessarily only espionage of their time, but greater truth, the McCarthy era. I don't really know another book, another piece of art that captures the atmosphere of those times very well.
The Invasion of the Body Snatchers might be the only one I can
close
think
second
of.
Maybe, yes. So this is where I'm coming from.
One of the things that I really like about Tinker Tailor, and I'm an enormous fan of the book and of the movie and of the Alec Guinness TV series done back in, the 80s, I guess, is that unlike The Sandbaggers, unlike Argo, unlike my favorite current television show about spies, The Americans, it doesn't turn everything up to 11, right? I mean, all those things, all those that I just mentioned, you've touched on them, have substantial basis in sort of real ideas and real operations, but are turned up unrealistically. It meant great entertainment, but unrealistic in that regard. But Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, you know, makes a virtue out of, like, you know, we're going to turn this down, right?
Yep.
We're going to dial this down. Everything's going to be just
very
on an
cerebral,
even keel, and it's like, you know, very calm above. It's like ducks, you know, like calm above and like lots of paddling below, and you have to sort of imagine what's the turmoil going on in people's brains. I think that makes it fabulous art, both written and on the screen.
I will say, though, for The Americans, and just very briefly, I had the same concerns. Oh, this is just sort of a wild, harebrained, TV show. But actually, if you look at the individual cases, I think they're all based on real cases. Of course, it never happened, you know, so convoluted and all in one sitting. But the individual cases, I think, were based on actual spy cases.
Yeah, very
so
much
it's,
so.
It's not a bad series, actually. Well, I was positive.
The equipment is a period appropriate, and it's certainly something that would be used. I mean, there certainly were illegals. There are illegals. They wouldn't necessarily be knocking people off every week. But what's great about Tinker Tailor Soldier, when you have 6 hours to do a miniseries, you can really take your time.
Yes.
And I think that's something that they did very well. The movie was a little more rushed, but they were able to kind of...
Well, and that's a very good point. And in counterintelligence, well, frankly, most intelligence work, but counterintelligence particularly, I would say, in the real world, cases unfold over, you know, months is fast. Right?
Right.
Years is realistic. Sometimes, occasionally, even decades. And so with the TV series with Alec Guinness, that's a very good point. I never thought about that. It gives you some sense of this. So this is just one tiny little piece at a time, and eventually we're going to build this big, huge edifice, but it takes a long time.
Well, it'd be near impossible if you've read The Billion Dollar Spy about Adolf Tolkachev. There's great stories in there about how CIA officers had to get black, how they lose KGB surveillance in order to meet with Tolkachev. It's the first penetration agent inside the Soviet Union, and it took them 8 hours to be fully sure that there was no... I mean, how could you do that in a movie, right? It would be walking around and sitting on park benches and changing cabs and buses. It would be... Even a TV show, The Americans wouldn't have lasted more than two episodes before it was canceled, because no one would have watched it. And that's where you get the advantage of having the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy miniseries, where people are going to watch Alec Guinness in Britain one way or the other, and so they could take their time. But it's very rare that you're able to do that in any kind of American series or even a movie that's 2 hours long.
Yeah, we prefer things like 24.
That's why I was going to say that, and in a way, the question is kind of a trick question, because they're just, nothing is realistic on TV or in the movies. If it was, it wouldn't be entertainment at all, because just as you say, these things take a long time. Most of it is quite painstaking. Paperwork, people aren't going out killing people, there's not a lot of sex. I mean, all those things. It doesn't actually lend itself to entertainment. And so, you know, we're talking about sort of rare examples where there's an element of of something accurate in some of these series. And it was funny because I was you think about The Americans, because it is sort of known for being praised for being a realistic TV series. And of course it's realistic because it deals with, yes, some real plot lines, the realism that there were and are illegals or sleeper spies. But, you know, beyond that, there's not a lot that's really realistic about what they do. And I was thinking about this difference between British and American shows. It does tend that the British seems to be a little bit better at getting out of that realism. And it's not just the shows, it's the writers, it's the Le Carré model and so on, which maybe deals with some more of these cerebral intellectual themes that seem to lend themselves, seem to make us feel like it is more realistic, right? That this is really, that intelligence is not so much an action and shoot 'em up kind of discipline, but it's one that lends itself to really thinking. The show I was thinking about, I don't know if it's my favorites, but I happened to watch it quite recently, and which is a British show about sleepers, sort of, let's say, the British equivalent of the Americans, called The Game, which was also a 6-part BBC series on a couple of years ago, which I just happened to watch on a recommendation. And it's set in the 1970s, not in the 80s. And I think there's something really interesting as well about these shows that they're making today, which are set during the Cold War. And it does make us think,
the good old days.
Yeah, all the good old days. And also, one of the things I like about that The Game is again, the depiction of tradecraft, which in The Americans as well has some nice, you know, tradecraft in it. And there's something about the Cold War, that Cold War period, with that kind of tradecraft, which, you know, the dead drops, right? I was in The Game, there's something as simple as steaming open an envelope with a boiling tea kettle, you know, which is not even Cold War tradecraft, right? It goes back way, way earlier than that. That maybe, you know, modern day tradecraft, I guess the computerization of things, you know, it's just, it doesn't seem as fun, does it, to show that. So the Game is, again, is about a sleeper agent, Soviet sleepers in Great Britain. It's set in the 70s. It's got that kind of gritty dinginess to it. It rains a lot, which somehow makes us feel like it's more real. And it's about a sort of small team at MI5, again, that is looking into this Soviet plot. It's called Operation Glass, which they're basically told is going to be a game changer in the Cold War. One of the things I like about it is you get a sense of these bureaucratic rivalries between MI5 and MI6. You know, whose territory is this? This is a time in the 1970s where Britain was going through some economic hardships. There are power cuts. There are cuts being made in budgets and things like that. And you really get a sense that they're operating as well as they can, given the limitations. The head of MI6, who forms this little team to look into Operation Glass, is just known as Daddy. That's his name. It's like C or M, and they all call him Daddy. And nobody ever explains where that comes from, but it just seems very appropriate somehow. It's got some great characters. It's got a lot of intrigue. Again, it's got those 6 episodes where you can really sort of drag out, or you can tell a complicated stretch out, that's better. You can tell a complicated story over time without having to fill it in and into these, you know, 2 hours. And there's violence, there's killing, somebody gets killed in every single episode, but it doesn't seem actually there's this aversion to killing, and that's one of the things I really like about it. You know, it's sort of, this isn't what we do. So I really recommend it if you can find it online or on DVD, the game. It's a really intriguing and entertaining drama that does sort of convey some of the work, the busy work that gets done. One of the things I like is whenever they show these scenes of MI5, you see a lot of these little cubicles where people are just kind of working away at their desks. MI5 looks like a distinctly unglamorous place.
Well, Vince, do you have a candidate?
So mine will be a lot easier to find, because if you grew up in the 80s like me, this was on USA or TBS every other day. And it's very similar in vein to The Hunt for Red October, which comes later. And this is a movie called Firefox. And people can chuckle. It's a Clint Eastwood movie. And because my background is S&T, and so this is really one of the key technical collection spy movies of the 1980s. And if you know the basic plot, Clint Eastwood is a Vietnam vet whose mother was Russian, so he speaks Russian fluently without an accent. And he is brought back in. He's retired, or he's gone, because he's got severe PTSD, and he's brought back in by CIA and MI6 to do a mission inside the Soviet Union to steal their state-of-the-art new prototype fighter aircraft called the Firefox, which flies at Mach 5 or 6. It's stealth. It has thought-controlled weapons systems, although you have to think in Russian to fire them off, which is a nice little plot point. But the reason I like it is because the movie is not realistic at all. There is some nice back and forth with the KGB chasing the dissidents inside Moscow near the beginning of the movie. The reason I like it is what rings true about it is this whole idea of technical collection. This is something during the 60s, 70s, and 80s that the United States was very good at. Whether you're talking about Glomar Explorer or just keep it very topical, the idea of acquiring information about Soviet aircraft through stealing them or defectors or getting their hands on them. The real story starts back in the 60s with the MiG-17. The only thing we really knew about it was because an East German defector flew one to West Germany and said, I'd like to defect, and that's how we were able to learn about the MiG-17. In the 70s, the very famous case of Viktor Belenko, who flew his MiG-25 to Japan. This is one of the fun stories. We took it apart piece by piece and returned the pieces to the Soviets with a smile on our face saying, here's your plane back. Don't say we stole it from you. And then you can see this with also the Mossad, the Israelis, Operation Diamond, where they offered hundreds of thousands of dollars to any Iraqi pilots to defect. And that's how we found about the MiG-21, where Middle Eastern pilots were coming to the Israelis, and they eventually would pass along to the United States. So it's kind of this, it has this undercurrent of truth. The idea that we didn't have the ability, and most scientific and technological intelligence is very difficult, especially the scientific side. It's not hard to figure out how good is the new Russian tank against a SABO round, a depleted uranium round, because the Army is very good at figuring this stuff out. It's much more difficult getting inside laboratories. It's much more difficult getting at the prototype level, because unless you can get inside the actual labs and talk to the scientists, then you don't really know how things work. So in this case, we decided to get our hands on the finished product, either by having a defector or, in the case of Firefox, by stealing the aircraft. But there are some real interesting concepts when you talk about dissidents within the Soviet Union. They're helped along by dissidents who are Jewish and don't like the way the Soviets treated the Jewish population. They're helped by scientists who are working within the advanced research inside the Soviet Union and are unable to pass information along to the Americans, but are there and willing to help Clint Eastwood once he shows up to help steal the Firefox. And there's some fun action scenes in the movie, too. He basically takes this play into levels that you've never seen before. One of my funniest little, you really kind of screwed that up moments in the movie was that he and the other prototype are now dogfighting at the end in the big climax in the movie, and the other pilot decides to shoot cannon, or machine gun, it's probably cannon, 20mm, at Clint Eastwood's plane as they're flying at full velocity, which is not possible. An M16 fires a bullet at 3,100 feet per second, which is much, 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 much slower than these aircraft are flying at. So even as like a 6-year-old when I was
that's
watching
spitting
this,
into the wind is
yeah,
what it is.
Basically you're shooting yourself with that or shooting someone behind you. So even as a 6-year-old, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. But now it really doesn't. But I'm going to be able to forgive it, because I think the movie is fun. It's one of these rare Saturday afternoon movies that you can watch and go, you know what, they got some of that right. Or at least they got the idea. The overall feeling of the movie has the basic concept down.
Yeah, it's a very fun movie, and your nomination of it reminds me of a conversation I had just the other day with a colleague who's just back from a business trip in Dayton, Ohio. And I don't know if you've been there. I have not, but the Air Force has a wonderful museum.
Wright-Patterson.
That is the museum for what, during much of the Cold War, was Air Force Intelligence's Foreign Technology Division. I think it has another name now. And so not only is it great on American aircraft, military aircraft, but also on German and Japanese and East Bloc aircraft from during the Cold War, because that was the primary place that stolen things like the fictional Firefox would end up and get taken apart and analyzed and stuck into the, you know, into the and tested and kept there then, and now you can see many of them. I'd like to think that there are some classified ones there you can't see, but you can see the old ones at least.
I think it might be worth mentioning just a few other movies I'm just thinking of, which are really, really great. And The Lives of Others, of course, is a wonderful film about the Stasi during the Cold War, and gives a really incredible look at how all pervasive Stasi surveillance was, that really digging into ordinary people's lives. It's really a great film, a very moving film, and I think has a lot to say for sort of reflecting some of the tension of the times and that feeling of being watched. And then I was thinking something much more contemporary, Zero Dark Thirty, which I know has been criticized for aspects of it that are not realistic. The idea that this one analyst is responsible for finding Bin Laden, which is not the reality. It was certainly a team effort. But I think it has a lot to say for it in terms of showing how analysis really was critical in hunting down Bin Laden. And I know when I saw it, I just felt that tension from the very beginning of the movie up until the end of the movie, and then that kind of sense of relief and release at the end when he was finally gotten. And it did make me feel what it might have been like in some way for these analysts who for 10 years devoted their lives to trying to find this individual. And what it might have felt like at the end when they actually succeeded. So I think those are two films that I can think of which do a pretty good job, as far as is possible, of depicting some of the reality of intelligence work.
Maybe just very briefly, and that could lead to the next question. All of these movies, of course, depict aspects of intelligence, and they raise some bigger questions. And when you only look at these movies, often you come away with a feeling how powerful intelligence is. If you think of Firefox, you know, you just have to steal that plane. And I'm sure it happened. I mean, or things that happened similarly. The next question is, of course, once you have that plane, what do you do with it? And there is some, you know, fairly recent research that suggested, you know, when that happened on the Soviet side, they actually had a very hard time, you know, using that intelligence to then implement that in their own industrial process. And they might have been stealing that plane, but they couldn't really do very little with it. Same story with the East Germans. They managed to steal these microchips, but they couldn't actually use them for their own computers. And the list goes on. So I think these movies are really fun to look at, and they depict realistic aspects of intelligence, but then that leads to the next question, well, what can intelligence actually do, and what are the dangers in intelligence analysis? And maybe you want to lead up to that with your the next question we got from the audience.
Yeah, the next question really kind of delves into that in a very specific way. The question is, it's no coincidence that the analysis offered on this show by people who trained for and worked in intelligence field is of high quality, thank you. But there are always outside forces that they have to contend with, e.g., pressure from politicians to deliver intelligence with backs up rather than challenges their own viewpoints. Where the available intelligence runs counter to the political desires of the day, it may be ignored altogether. So I wonder, is there an effective way to counteract these pressures, or is the reality that intelligence will always be subject to a sort of politicized cherry picking?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and there certainly is a lot of truth to the fact that policymakers, whether they're military leaders or, you know, the president or whoever, often don't like the news that intelligence analysts give them. There's an old joke that policymakers use intelligence the way a drunk uses a lamppost, for support rather than illumination, i.e. that, you know, from when it comes to relations with the policymakers aren't always necessarily intellectually honest, if you will. That said, at least in the U.S. system, it's actually very, very difficult to have, to conduct retaliation against an analyst who delivers bad news. Analysts operate through a different chain, and they tend to have civil service protections. There's some very rare individual cases you can come up with, but the fact of the matter is that delivering bad news feels to an intelligence analyst much more dangerous than actually it is.
But you can retaliate against the agency itself. I mean, the torture report is a great example of this, where it came from one side of the aisle, it was entirely Democratic, and it took the CIA to the woodshed. And you can now see, I guess a couple of days ago, a court decided that these two psychologists who developed the enhanced interrogation program can be taken to court. Now, whether that happens or not, or whatever.
No, it's a good point, and that's a very good point. And that is that analysts and people conducting operations, in this case, you know, a certain form of collection, right, through interrogation and I believe at least some of it was torture. That's a different deal from the question of delivering bad news, you know, from analysis, right? You know, President Johnson, we're very sorry, the Vietnam War is not actually going very well, right? That may get the agency you work for in trouble sort of collectively. You're absolutely right. I mean, Richard Nixon, for instance, basically didn't have the time of day for CIA. CIA, and also to a lesser extent, State and INR's views of Soviet intentions during the 1970s got them on the wrong end of a lot of ridicule and abuse from Congress. But that's a different question from reaching down in and having GS-13 Mark Stout, you know, fired because, you know, he didn't suck up to the president or the secretary of state. There are cases of that are extraordinarily rare. But, and your chain will almost always back you up.
But there's a much more subtle way that politicization can happen, and that's in the question being asked by policymakers in the first place. I mean, take Iraqi WMD. If the White House asks, are there weapons of mass destruction, it's a very different question than where are the weapons of mass destruction. Now, it sounds nuanced, but that is a tasking saying they are there, go find them, versus the very open-ended question saying, do they exist? You know, and that's – when I teach this, when I teach the intelligence cycle, I leave targeting / tasking out till the end. So it's very controversial because people go, oh, well, they can't have me fired. But when the president of the United States is asking you a question that has that kind of weight to it, I don't care if you're not worried about your job. That's going to affect the way that you react.
No, that is absolutely correct. And one of the tasks of, you know, good intelligence analysts and good intelligence agencies is to make sure that I don't know quite how to put this, but that not only do you ask the question answer the question that was asked, but also that you answer the question that should have been asked. You know, we don't know where they are, and in fact, by the way, we're not sure they're anywhere in that particular case. But that is a very, very difficult thing to do. There's no question about it.
Well, I do think, first of all, intelligence agencies, they don't operate in a vacuum. They're part of the government. And when the government has an agenda, I do think there is a tendency, it's a very human tendency throughout the government, including the intelligence agencies, to work toward that agenda. If you're being told as an analyst, we're looking for this piece of information and, well, I haven't found it, well, please look again, please look again, please look again, especially with something that is so vague as weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction, what could that mean? Well, we're all thinking nuclear, but technically it means biological, chemical. I mean, I can produce that in my garage. And do you want to be the analyst who says, well, in all of Iraq, there's not a single chemical weapon? No, certainly you don't.
No.
Certainly you don't. Retaliation, you're absolutely right. Of course, firing someone.
There were some stray chemical rounds found in Iraq.
Sure, sure. Everybody has them. You know, I got some at home. You know, we all do.
Don't want to hear about that.
But of course, we're thinking nuclear, and there's already this conflation between the issues. So just by posing that question, you're already putting a spin on things. So that is one thing. Then, of course, the lack of oversight. Government outside the intelligence community, there's a certain degree of oversight. There's the press, there are oversight committees, there's all of us. We can look at what the IRA does. And if we don't like it, then, there'll be blowback. Now, with the intelligence community, it has to operate in secrecy up to a point. Otherwise, it can't do its work. But it also means that these things happen in a place that most Americans don't see. So spinning and agendas, become more pronounced. And I think when you have a government with an agenda, be it here in the United States or somewhere else, it gets very, very difficult to have a professional process. As I said, retaliation can have many forms. Maybe you don't get fired, but you don't get the promotion. Maybe you don't get fired, but you don't get to serve in that cool country where everybody wants to serve. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
Chief of station of Uganda or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
Nothing against you guys.
But. And, that's just the United States. I mean, if you look at the world in general, I think sort of as a general rule of thumb, the more authoritarian a regime is, the more difficult it will be for an intelligence service to be professional and, tell truth to power, because that could ultimately be lethal. And there are many examples of that. Unfortunately, here we have a democracy. But certainly, when there's an agenda, I think, for an intelligence service, it's very, very difficult. So the guidance has to come from top. And I think now we're much more aware of that than we were 20 years ago.
What secrecy allows people to do, also politicians especially, is to claim they didn't know about something. a good example of this is the NSA programs of the last decade, whether it's Stellar Wind or PRISM or all these, where there's clear indication that members of Congress on both sides of the aisle were briefed several times on this. Whether they listened or not, we'll never know. But they were able to come out and say, I had no idea about this, because it wasn't made public. And it was something they were able to say, I'm completely incensed about this. I can't believe this is happening. I'm blown away. In some cases, the intelligence community goes, yeah, but you were at all these briefings that you were, we told you about this. But people are allowed to say, at least get away with it, because the public doesn't know any better. I didn't know about this either. This isn't my fault. Blame the NSA. They're the rogue agency. And of course, when that comes up, when the rogue agency concept comes up, those of us in the know just cringe, because there's no such thing. Even going back to the 70s, what the Church and Pike Committee decided was that there's no such thing as a rogue agency.
And they went in with the expectation that's what they were going to find.
Right.
And then to their credit, they came out saying, we don't approve a lot of stuff that went on, but it wasn't because the CIA or et cetera was a rogue agency.
Well, and that's similarly true for the last, whether it's with Snowden revelations, whether it's enhanced interrogation, whether it's rendition, all the things that everyone, CIA directors and NSA directors got, dragged over the coals by Congress, turned out to be directed from the very top. And but in many cases, and this is not a case of Republicans versus Democrats, in many cases, they were essentially left to dangle in the wind by the politicians in the White House and in Congress, because it was easier to use the political argument against them than it was to kind of suck it up and say, yeah, we knew about this. We said it was okay. We directed it from the White House. Much easier to say the American public, oh, this wasn't us. This was the CIA going rogue.
I think what all these comments are saying is that it's a much more complicated picture than simply, pressure being put on one analyst. I mean, this is something where you have to look all along the line. And, we've talked about Iraq because it is the obvious example here, at least in recent years, you say politicization of intelligence and people think Iraq. And that's one where you have to look at a certain amount of complicity all along the chain. I mean, that it's not just because, there was political pressure put on one analyst or one group of analysts, and they were trying to get the answer. We have to look at all along line, the analysts, the managers, the policymakers, Congress, the press. There's many different factors involved. I mean, the politics and policy are always going to be entwined, and separating them entirely is probably is unrealistic. I do think in recent years there's been a lot more attention paid toward trying to separate politics and policy, trying to look at the intelligence community and trying to separate, trying to protect analysts, for example, trying to allow them greater ability to express opinions, even if they are ones that the policymakers don't want to hear, and so on. And I think we're probably in a period where we're going to pay a lot of attention to that. And if you look at the ebb and flow of things, probably at some point, you know, the pendulum will swing in one direction again, and we'll deal with this again, and then we'll correct it. Just because it's in the air and I happen to know something about it, I was thinking about these 28 pages of the joint congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks, which has become
28 pages that are supposedly about Saudi Arabia, possibly Saudi Arabia's connection with the 9/11
attacks. I don't think it's supposedly about. I mean, they are about Saudi Arabia. What they're about is another thing. And again, this is. I mean, if you want to call that an intelligence product, it's been utterly politicized right now. I mean, it's being used for political purposes. You mentioned how. If you make something secret and all the sort of consequences that are to that, sometimes you make something secret and people assume that it must be important, right? That it must be influential. Some people assume that it must say something bad about the government or whatever. That's why we need to cover it up. You know, why won't you release this information? Aha, you must be covering yourself, or you must have something, it must play into some other agenda. I mean, you know, there are a lot of reasons why things are kept secret. It was certainly right now, and for good reasons, the American public does seem to assume the worst, which isn't always the case. And that's a problem. And I heard a number of our leaders talk about that there's too much secrecy. And there is this very fine balance that you have to have between enough secrecy in order to for intelligence community to actually work effectively. But if you have too much, then you actually lose the support of the people.
Yeah, I think pretty much anybody who's ever had a security clearance has very quickly learned that the vast majority of all classified information is monumentally uninteresting.
Absolutely.
To pretty much everybody in the entire world. It happens to be classified for any number of a gazillion reasons, but it's almost never because it's intrinsically sexy information.
Yeah, and there is this problem, and anybody who's ever had a security clearance understands it exactly, which is the default is classify it. Classify it unless there's a reason not to. When most other areas of life, it's this should be open unless there's a reason for it not to be.
Right. Well, I mean, you talked about the separation of politics and policy, and maybe that's not a good thing. I mean, political sustainability is a key component now for intelligence operations because budgets matter. And if you're going to run a program like I'm thinking of some of the NSA programs, which are incredibly expensive, the wave of politics, the overall feelings of the American public matter in what you can get away with. And I don't mean that in a, can we get one over on people? I mean, the fact is, how far can you go? And since there's been 15 years now since a major attack on the United States, the public is far less willing to accept intrusions on privacy. And on 9/12/2001, it's the exact opposite. And so intelligence agencies understanding how politics affects their job is incredibly important. I mean, the ability to sustain things on a budgetary situation, on a political situation, you know, the idea is, are we going to get pulled in front of a HPSC or SSCI, or are we going to get raked over the coals in the press? Are things in a democracy, in a country such as ours, where the intelligence agencies are tools of the executive, these are things that have to be considered. And I think, like you said, it's completely unrealistic to expect that we can eliminate politics completely, not in a country like even in totalitarian states, there's still elements of politics that overhang intelligence agencies. I mean, Lavrenty Beria arguably was the most powerful head of the Soviet intelligence service, and politics everywhere. I mean, he ends up being the last person killed in the Stalinist terror, which is so wonderfully ironic, was because of all these politics, all the people that he had pissed off and trying to get these, the terror that he ran.
I do think that, I agree with that. I think that, we've said, and I frequently say, sort of bad things implicitly about policymakers. But I got to say that intelligence officers, particularly intelligence analysts, are a fundamentally different beast from policymakers. Intelligence analysts, I like to say to my class, intelligence analysts are like Hamlet. They're sort of, well, on the one hand, on the other hand, I don't know, you know, wring your hands, kind of inclined towards pessimism. And policymakers are like George S. Patton. I hear you. Here's what we're going to do, right? We pay policymakers to do hard stuff. And so when a policymaker says to an intelligence analyst, I hear you when you say that, you know, everything's going down the tubes, I think you're wrong. In some sense, that's good. Because, you know, if it was easy, we wouldn't need to, you know, it would take care of itself, right? We pay presidents and generals and admirals and diplomats to go out and solve really hard problems for us. And if they were, you know, if they had the pessimistic worldview and the shades of gray nuance and not sure I fully understand yet kind of approach that intelligence analysts do, they'd never get anything done. So there's always going to be a certain degree of culture clash, if you will, of the one against the other, and the trick is just to ensure that relationship isn't abused. I think.
Well, precisely. I mean, this is exactly the point. Of course, ideally, they would be separated, and the intelligence analysts do their thing, and the policymakers do the other. The problem is that the policymakers are of course above the analysts. They should be. Of course, they don't operate in separate worlds, but that of course is also a power relationship. And I think in the past there were cases where analysis was not liked and there was retribution in one way or another, subtle or less subtle, and that is the problem. And, you know, you mentioned Beria, of course, it goes completely out of control in totalitarian system where control is total and where you have to be very careful what you say. But it happens in more subtle ways in democracies too. And so, yes, ideally they should be separated. I completely agree with you. But in reality, they're not. And that's something that you got to keep in mind when you look at these things. But I do think we've come a long way, yeah. And this is an instant. You know, I'm a historian, and you always like to think, well, maybe you can learn from the past, and often you can't. But I think in this particular incident, actually, the progress was made, and I think the intelligence community is in much better shape today and integrated into government decision-making process than it was even 15 years ago or so.
Let's tackle our third question, and it is this: has there ever been an organization or country more impenetrable than ISIS? How do we acquire significant human sources against a group that is so fanatical and the punishment is so severe, meaning things like public beheadings, being burned alive? Historically, to the group, is there or has there been an organization or country that's more difficult to penetrate than currently ISIS? So the reason I think this question is interesting, and I jumped all over it, is if you watch the Democratic primary debates when Martin O'Malley was still in the primary debates.
I vaguely remember him, yeah.
Yeah. You know, Mayor Carcetti from The Wire, if you remember him from the Democratic debates, he was the one that talked intelligence every once in a while. And he said, we need more human. We need more human to combat ISIS. And people are like, oh, well, he's talking about intelligence. But it didn't really seem like he had the concept down the way it was necessary to have the concept down, particularly considering it'd be very, very difficult to send human intelligence assets into ISIS for the obvious reasons, like we just talked about here. The life expectancy is very short, and your ending of life is very brutal. So with that in mind, can we come up with anything, at least historically, that even resembles that level of difficulty?
Well,
crickets, I love it.
No, I've got a candidate, but
Well, sure. I mean, let's talk about ISIS. And I profess I'm not an expert in ISIS. But one of the things that struck me when you look at these drastic countermeasures that organizations like ISIS take, and you find that in other organizations and systems too, the early Stalinist period, certainly Nazi Germany, medieval Europe, it could also be portrayed as a sign of weakness. Why do they have to take these strong measures? Well, there's great concern that there is betrayal. A lot of it is imagined, a lot of it is psychotic, but there's probably a kernel of truth. Now, I don't know, and I shouldn't know, what the CIA is doing to penetrate ISIS, but for all I know, maybe they're being very successful in this paranoia that they have about penetrations is not so far-fetched. I don't know. But then let's get away from human for a moment. Human penetration might be difficult, but certainly an organization like ISIS like any large organization, needs an infrastructure. And if you need an infrastructure, you need communications. Now, if you have communications, signals intelligence comes into play. And I would submit that the United States is vastly superior to an organization like ISIS in this regard.
You'd hope so, right?
I would hope so. And again, I don't think I'm you know, betraying any secret information. I think so. I'm pretty sure they are. There was a case when Osama bin Laden was still alive, a story in the newspaper that they were trying to track him, you know, by him using his cell phone. And then when the story was in the newspaper, he stopped using it. But it all goes to show these people rely on communications. I think the NSA is probably the best signals intelligence agency in the world, and I would think they're using this and other means to penetrate ISIS. So I'm actually not that concerned about ISIS as such. I think they stand and fall with their acceptance in the Middle East, and that seems to be on the decline.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Alexis.
I was just going to say I'm always skeptical. I guess as an historian, I'm always acceptable of thinking that there's anything new, there's anything that is completely and utterly new, like we've never seen this before. I think, as you're right, the brutality of ISIS, this isn't new. I mean, you don't have to look back that far. I mean, the brutality in the Soviet Union or in the Eastern Bloc in general, in East Germany, going back to World War II, the brutality of the Gestapo and Hitler's regime, going back into, brutality is nothing new. I think the ability to take videos of people being beheaded and put them on YouTube for everybody to see is something new. The publicity, the PR aspect of this, and using some of these new communication methods of the modern world. Means that more people are seeing these things and have greater access to it. There are probably new aspects of that, but I think probably the essential nature of this is not that new. Just even going back to the Cold War, it's not as if the CIA had did a very good job at penetrating the Soviet Union in any way whatsoever. Not true, vice versa. The CIA did a great job at penetrating the United States. I believe they did.
The KGB did a good job at penetrating the United States.
Did I say? I'm
you
sorry,
said the CIA did a good job at penetrating the United States.
Oh, sorry about that. Shouldn't be talking
about
that.
Can we back
that
up to maybe
that part
answer
out.
That bit anyway, again?
Yeah, cut that out.
Freudian slip.
I guess I know more than I thought I did.
Leave it in.
Yeah, leave it in. Anyway, it's not as if the CIA did a great job at penetrating the Soviet Union during the Cold War. I think... the idea that ISIS is impenetrable, I'm with Thomas here in thinking that we probably have a lot of ways of penetrating, and maybe not through humans, certainly through technical means. I'm pretty confident that if we haven't already found ways to penetrate, that we're working on it, and we'll probably get there at some point.
I'm a little less confident. I mean, I look at, when I saw this question, Cuba jumped into my head. Mm-hmm. And for those of you that don't know how successful Cuban intelligence has been against the United States, and again, that's the key against the United States, because they are pound for pound arguably the most successful intelligence agency in the world, and there's a little bit of a caveat to that statement in that they have one single foreign intelligence target, and that's the United States. If the CIA only had one target, no one would touch us. But in the case, the Cubans are only really focused on the U.S., but there's a great if you're the Cubans, not so great if you're us. We thought we had penetrated the Cubans many times, but it turns out that between 1962 and 1987, a 25-year period, not a single CIA or American intelligence source in Cuba worked for us. Every single one of them was doubled back against the United States. That's extraordinary. And the only reason we actually found out about this was not because we figured out our own stuff was rotten. There was a defector codenamed Touchdown that came to the United States and said, everything you thought you knew, everybody you thought you had working for you in Cuba was working for the Castros. And to me, brutality wasn't the key here, right? They weren't torturing their assets. They weren't torturing our assets. As much as the Cuban regime is not particularly nice to people, and there are political prisoners, and it is a totalitarian state, these people were working because they were patriotic, because they truly believed in the future of Cuba. They were true believers. And the fact that something 90 miles away that was, you know, these are people who are in a banana republic, they don't have the technical means to do this against us. Without the Soviets, they're nothing. The underestimation of Cuban intelligence was at our downfall because they ate our lunch for 25 straight years. And if we weren't lucky enough to get this defector, they might still be making us think that we had people in there giving us real information when, in fact, it was garbage the entire time.
And, in fact, we also know that the East Germans did something very similar to us as well. No, I agree with every single word that's just been said. I think these are all great points. But I want to go off just briefly in a slightly different direction and suggest that, yeah, there have been targets that are much more difficult to penetrate, even aside from the Cubans and the East Germans, and I think, for instance, and they would fit too. But for instance, you know, say Soviet military intelligence during the Cold War, the GRU, or current day North Korean military intelligence, right? These are organizations that are extremely security conscious, put you through all sorts of checks and, you know, and background investigations and blah 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 blah. And furthermore, by the nature of their work, American intelligence doesn't have a lot of opportunities to meet these people. You can't recruit somebody until you've met them,
right?
Extraordinarily difficult to get inside these organizations. Extremely difficult. And even then, you face the problem that we had with the Cubans and the East Germans of, you know, maybe doubling them. By contrast, I think that penetrating ISIS is actually probably not that difficult. Now, what may be difficult, and for the reason that basically they're trying to be a mass movement. Right now, they do put people through background checks, but their ability to do that is extraordinarily limited, right? And broadly speaking, because they're trying to be a mass movement, somebody who, you know, sticks up their hand and says, "I am a convert to Islam, and by the way, I come with an American passport, and you know, I am all behind this ISIS thing," they're kind of inclined to take you, right? I mean, if they reject you, then like they're not speaking for Islam, right? I mean, as they claim to be. So you can almost opt in yourself. You can't just opt into the GRU. I couldn't have stood up in the Cold War and said, you know, I'm feeling like a Soviet, I'm feeling like a commie, you should let me into the GRU. It just doesn't work that way. Whereas I have a public profile, I'm known to have formerly worked for the U.S. intelligence, so I couldn't do this, but maybe our friend over here who's our recording tech could do that with just a very little bit of backup. The difficulty comes in finding people willing to do it. Where that's where the brutality comes in.
Right.
Most people don't want to be, you know, burned to death or beheaded. But I think the actual doing it part is not so hard. And I think also, if you just to finish out, you know, ISIS is a relatively new phenomenon. But if you look even at Al-Qaeda and some of its other affiliates that have been around a little bit longer, just in the public domain, we know of, you know, at least a reasonable handful of people who in various ways, shapes, and forms have penetrated those organizations. Omar al-Nashiri, we had a defector Jamal al-Fadl from al-Qaeda, Al-Kai Collins, Morton Storm, I'm forgetting, there's a couple more that we know of in the public. So I'm not nearly so pessimistic about the possibilities of penetrating al-Qaeda in a human sense, you know, let alone getting to the technical intelligence collection things that I think Tom has quite rightly brought up. I would like to imagine, and I suspect it's probably true, that in SIGINT terms, we're eating their lunch. But so, yeah, I'm more optimistic on this question.
Well, thank you, Alexis, Mark, and Thomas. We will probably try to do this again in a couple months. So if you have questions you'd like to hear the panel answer, you can email them to us at spycast@spymuseum.org or tweet them to us at @intlspycast. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Spycast. Remember, every Tuesday we will post a new podcast available from both spymuseum.org and iTunes. If you have any questions or comments about Spycast, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org or leave a comment or review on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @intlspycast. That's @intlspycast. Talk to you next week.